Welcome to Citizens Climate Radio. In this podcast, we highlight people's stories, we celebrate your successes, and together we share strategies for talking about climate change. I'm your host, Peterson Toscano. Welcome to episode 17 of Citizens Climate Radio, a project of Citizens Climate Education. This episode is airing on Monday, October 23rd, 2017. In the Art House today, I share with you three books that look back at Hurricane Katrina. I'll tell you about a book of poetry, some nonfiction, and a graphic novel. I also have several voicemails to play from all the people who answered the puzzler question about ugly windmills. But first, our main section. Last week, I traveled to the island of Manhattan and met with someone engaged in hurricane recovery efforts in Puerto Rico. Dr. Ophelia Magan shared with me a project from New York City that brings emergency power to Puerto Rico. In addition, Resilient Power Puerto Rico is working on plans for long-term solar production. Engineers and technicians from the mainland are on the ground in Puerto Rico right now, installing solar stations. They're also training engineering students and technicians on how to build and maintain these stations. I asked Ophelia for an update from the island. She read a recent blog post by Walter Mayer, a co-founder of Resilient Power Puerto Rico.
The ride from San Juan into the isolated towns of the West was a journey back to the Stone Ages. We arrived to stories of fallen trees that trapped people in their houses for days after the storm. 3 weeks after the storm, there's no water without price gouging, catching rain, or securitized rations, and communications are spotty, our satellite phone included. Projections for complete island power restoration have slid from 6 months to a year, with rumors of a two-year window of expectations. The big battery producers are positioning for the large microgrids. Organizers such as Resilient Power Puerto Rico will complement from the ground up with community-based solar and meet in the middle much sooner than formal projections. A selfless team of volunteer solar experts has been on the ground assessing sites this week, prepping for rapid installation.
Dr. Ophelia Magan lives in New York City. She is an educational designer and technologist at New York University.
So I have always had an interest in what I call catalyzing positive social action. So that led me to initially pursue careers in journalism and photojournalism. I came into academia and really fell in love with that space and what was possible. I just finished my doctorate at NYU last May. My dissertation focused on sort of the broad question was, how do you teach people about living sustainably and creating resilient built environments? As an educational designer, my passion and my pursuit is to address issues of climate change, resilience, sustainability.
Well, based on her studies, I had to ask, what have you learned about climate communication?
What I've learned is that it's quite a challenge, right? And it's really addressing both the learning aspect, you know, what people care about is a huge aspect of really shifting attitudes and behaviors in that space.
I also asked her what advice she has for us, those of us who want to be effective climate communicators.
Sometimes coming at it a little sideways can be very productive. And what I mean by that, trying to shift what people believe and what they feel about something really has to do with what motivates them a lot of times. So I attended a book talk last year by David Biello, who wrote a book about the Anthropocene. I asked him if he felt like people being able to contribute to solutions for the problem required that they actually believe in climate change. One of the other people on the panel talked about a group in Kansas, a family who had installed solar systems at all of their homes, right? But they were climate change deniers. So in the end, does it matter that they denied climate change if they were actually doing something that contributed to a solution, even if they were motivated by something wholly different than actually mitigating climate change?
NYU offered paid leave to employees who signed up for disaster relief. Ophelia jumped at the chance and got involved with Resilient Power Puerto Rico. In large part, she was motivated by what she encountered firsthand in 2012 during Superstorm Sandy. She saw the recovery efforts. These experiences taught her important lessons about disaster recovery and resiliency.
I had already started my dissertation work prior to Sandy, and Rockaway was both my research site and my home. You know, I got 4 feet of flooding in my home. It certainly disrupted my life and also my dissertation research for a period of time. So I was involved in a number of different community gardening initiatives, and those continued after Sandy, but it had a different tone, and many more people were engaged and wanting to be engaged in the conversation because it had affected them in such a very real and tangible and personal way. After Sandy, I resumed my dissertation research, but then also continued with the community gardening initiatives and getting involved on the peninsula in both the recovery process and cleaning up, but then also, you know, rebuilding and what that meant for this particular coastal community in New York. Dealing with mold remediation and having discussions about, you know, how to rebuild and what does it mean to live in a place that is so vulnerable and has so many risks for sea level rise, and, you know, living on a barrier peninsula between the Atlantic Ocean and Jamaica Bay, which is a tidal bay. Rockaway is a really interesting place. It's 11 miles long, and from one end of the peninsula to the other, you can look at it and see this very specific gradation when it comes to, you know, the people who live in a particular place and the resources that they have available to them economically and in terms of access to agencies and other kinds of support from society. When you have such a diverse population in such a small place as that, and so many people, you're going to run the whole gamut of experiences. So things that have gotten better, I think in general, the community has been engaged in a conversation for a number of years about what it means to protect themselves and their property from the next extreme weather event. And you've seen a number of wonderful projects like the building of dunes when they planned and rebuilt the boardwalk. That was a very particular consideration. And it's a beautiful space now that also has some resiliency measures built into it. You've seen people like Walter Meyer and Jennifer Bolstad, you know, really engaged in that conversation and helping the community learn about what it means to actually build in a way that is both sustainable and resilient. And people on an individual level, people making decisions to invest in doing things like raising their homes. Community gardening is something that's really taken off on the peninsula. People having an understanding of growing their own food and what that also means in terms of living sustainably and creating resilient environments for themselves. But then you see other people rebuilding the same way that they had done before, you know, with full basements in, you know, again, a barrier peninsula, which, you know, when the next storm comes, what is that going to mean for not only their property, you know, but for themselves as well. As much as the storms in, you know, Sandy and Rockaway, Harvey and Irma have really challenged and created dire circumstances in different parts of the mainland, the United States, even in Rockaway, there was a bridge we could drive over to get electricity, to have, you know, sleep in a warm bed and have a hot meal. In Puerto Rico and Dominica and the Virgin Islands and so many other places, that isn't possible. Even right now, 3 weeks after the storm, when you have such badly damaged infrastructure, it's a gargantuan problem. And it's one that, you know, has to be addressed from an individual perspective and in the community and in grassroots levels, and then certainly from the big view of government and the long-term planning that's going to be required to rebuild the electrical grid, for example. Resilient Power Puerto Rico was really targeting these nimble efforts to deliver these solar systems to underserved public areas, prioritizing initially life-critical services, such as medical clinics, restaurants that might serve as soup kitchens and food distribution centers with a little bit of electricity, potentially serve food up to 1,000 people per day. So once this initial phase of response, dealing with these life critical services is established and up and running, then the conversation can turn to more long-term disaster preparedness and clean energy solutions that will impact the entire island. Part of this idea is this each one teach one approach to the installation. So our group has connected with some folks in Puerto Rico, including some engineering students from different universities, for them to engage with the solar experts that travel down there to do the installation so that they know then how to maintain the systems that are built, and then to be informed in this longer term conversation, subsequently to even be able to build systems themselves moving forward. Really, it is meant, as Walter said, to approach it from both ends of the spectrum and work together toward the same goal and to complement one another's efforts. In the first sort of 10 days or 2 weeks of the project, we were able to raise about $200,000 and then receive in-kind donations of equipment and other materials that took everything to close to $1 million, which is really phenomenal. And again, the New York City solar community came through in such a massive, massive way. We had a lot of supporters who donated their time, which if you to put a number on that, would send that number, I think, skyrocketing. The first deployment that we sent down included 10 solar experts, and they were based in the western end of the peninsula. And they're actually heading back to New York today. And with pictures and video and some more concrete information about the number of installations that they were able to do in this first deployment.
Now, I don't know about you, but when I hear about storm recovery efforts in other parts of the country and people traveling there to help out, I wonder, what on earth could I possibly do that would be helpful? I mean, I have no hard skills. For me to travel to these disaster sites, I would just be a liability with nothing to offer. So I was so pleased to hear of the many ways Ophelia and others found to serve without actually having to leave New York City.
On one day, we had people not just in New York, but even outside of the city, who were the solar engineers and technicians who were looking at the inventory of equipment that we had and then designing the systems, which is a major part of the effort, helping them sort of coordinate what is it that we had and where is it and what's prioritized to go and all those logistics. But then while also working to try and secure transport for our team, as well as the equipment into Puerto Rico. As you might be aware, the ports are really backed up. Transporting specialized equipment, in particular batteries, can be quite the logistical nightmare. And then making sure that when our team got there, that they were going to be able to be self-supporting. And so there is quite the demand for MREs these days. So tracking down stable food that they could take with them, making sure that they had water filters, because especially in the western end of Puerto Rico, as I understand it, the water in a place in Aguadilla even was just turned on the other day, but it still requires filtering. I was helping just do what needed to be done while also fielding requests for donations. So many people came through in a big way to make sure that we were able to have all the equipment that we needed for building the solar systems, but then also to make sure that our team is going to be taken care of when they got on the ground there. The project itself involves scratch building, what we call scratch building these systems. By getting these below wholesale or free overstock components to scratch build systems, we're able to do that for about $1 to $2 a watt. So this means that each donated dollar was going to materials only, and then ended up costing about a tenth of what a turnkey solar generator might cost. And then we had this added benefit of being able to teach people how to maintain and build their own systems because we were building them on site. So sourcing all of those materials was one piece of the work that we were doing. And the New York solar community really came through in an incredible way with donations, but also people showing up.
So what can someone like me do when it comes to disaster relief?
That can be anything from donating. I know that New York City fire stations are still accepting donations at a number of different locations for different materials that they'll make sure get down to Puerto Rico and distributed. Obviously, financial contributions make all the difference in a group such as Resilient Power Puerto Rico, which is an all-volunteer effort, being able to do the work that we did and to do it so quickly and to mobilize to get off the ground. So anybody who can make a financial contribution. We've also had some really creative responses for support. A group of musicians led by a DJ named Nicodemus, who hosted a fundraiser in New York last night, and they put together a compilation album that they are selling and donating the proceeds to both Resilient Power Puerto Rico and Waves for Water and other organizations. We had a school in Brooklyn who hosted a fundraiser for us. So the students all coming together and seeing what they could do to contribute to the effort, but then also people making connections to other folks that they know who might be able to contribute expertise or knowledge. Some of the solar experts were not able to, just hop on a plane and go to Puerto Rico for 7 to 10 days. And they were the ones who did the heavy lifting with designing the systems, which was a huge contribution. You say you don't have the hard skills. We had people showing up in the office who were helping to create spreadsheets and do research and find information, but then also folks who showed up and put some gloves on and helped stack solar panels. Each one of those individuals who made the effort and showed up even for just a couple of hours, it made all the difference in our team being able to very quickly prepare for this project and then get off the ground to be able to go.
It's been about a week since I've spoken with Ophelia. The donations keep coming in. So far, they've received $250,000 in financial donations and in-kind donations of equipment from all over the place, from New York to Illinois, California, and Florida. There have been large donors like Kara Walker and lots of individual smaller donors. They've received incredible support also from government, the Manhattan Borough President's Office, the Hispanic Federation, Governor Cuomo's office, Congresswoman Velasquez's office, and other individuals with various agencies and organizations who are working to respond to the devastation in Puerto Rico. You can learn a lot more about Resilient Power Puerto Rico over at their website, resilientpowerpr.org. That's resilientpowerpr.org. They have regular updates, and if you want to contribute, you can go there. Also, on our blog post, you will see a Dig Deeper section where I've got lots of links to other stories about Puerto Rico and the work that's going on there. Just go to citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to find the blog post for episode 17, and all of the links will be there. Now it is time for the Art House. The U.S. mainland and several Caribbean islands are still reeling from a series of hurricanes and tropical storms. 12 years ago, after Hurricane Katrina slammed into New Orleans, a lot of research analyzed the evacuation, rescue, and recovery efforts. What went wrong? Who is to blame? What must we do differently in preparing for future storms? The suffering of those who survived Katrina and those who didn't also moved artists to take a deeper look. Using film, TV series, creative nonfiction, songs, and visual arts, artists have documented and explored what happened during and after Katrina. What first appeared to be a natural disaster soon turned into a man-made catastrophe. Residents in New Orleans experienced injustice and human rights abuses. In the Art House today, I share with you three very different books that artfully expose the tragedy in New Orleans during and after Hurricane Katrina. The first book is a graphic novel. This way of telling stories has become popular and mainstream over the past decade. cartoonist Josh Newfield illustrates what happened to a handful of real-life people who survived the storm. The Los Angeles Times called Newfield's graphic novel a work of literature, of high art, and of reverence for nature and humanity. The book is called A.D. New Orleans, After the Deluge. By focusing on people from different ages, classes, ethnic, and racial backgrounds, Newfield reveals a diversity of experiences they faced. Here's a description of the five groups of people in the novel. Denise, a counselor and social worker and a sixth-generation New Orlean. The Doctor, a proud fixture of the French Quarter. Abbas and Dranel, two friends who faced the storm from Abbas's family-run market. Kwame, a pastor's son just entering his senior year of high school, and the young couple Lou and Michelle, who both grew up in the city. The images are beautiful and powerful. The stories are compelling. Again, it's called A.D. New Orleans After the Deluge by Josh Newfield. It's published by Pantheon. The next book is nonfiction, written by Dave Eggers. He also looks at individuals to get a grasp of the much larger story of Katrina. In his book, Zaytoun, he follows a Syrian-American and his American-born wife and their children before, during, and after the storm. Eggers goes deep into the background of the Zaytoun family. The true story unfolds like an epic. It's inspiring, frustrating, shocking, and deeply moving. It is described as the true story of one family caught between America's two biggest policy disasters, the War on Terror and the response to Hurricane Katrina. The book is Zaytoun, that's spelled Zeitoun, by Dave Eggers. It's published by Vantage Books. Finally, I want to point you to a book of poetry by Patricia Smith. It's called Blood Dazzler. About the book and its author, the writer Mark Doty said the following. This riveting sequence gives voice to a wild, raw whirlwind that ruined a city and brought on, in turn, a storm of neglect and murderous indifference. With her radiant powers of empathy, her fiercely acute ear for the musical possibilities of American speech, and her undiluted rage, Patricia Smith makes in Katrina's wake a sorrowful, unflinching, and glorious book. That is Blood Dazzler by Patricia Smith. It's available through Coffee House Press. So, the three books that artfully and lovingly look back at the human stories of Hurricane Katrina are A.D. New Orleans, After the Deluge by Josh Newfield, Zaytoun by Dave Eggers, and Blood Dazzler by Patricia Smith. You can get them wherever books are sold. If you have an idea for the Art House, feel free to contact me, radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. Now it is time for our puzzler question. You were chatting with an acquaintance, let's call him Larry. Somehow you got talking about windmills and the rapid advances in renewable technology. Larry's sympathetic, but bothered by something. He says, yeah, I get it, but these windmills, they look so ugly. I hate how they're ruining the countryside. Have you heard that before? So what would you say to Larry? I received several responses, including the following voicemails.
Hello, this is Jonathan Abbott calling you from the UK, Peterson. You wanted a response to Larry, and what would I say to him? I'd say to him, Larry, you're right to value beauty and oppose ugliness, but we get used to things. I was driving through Oklahoma in June, and I was struck by the sight of wind turbines next to an oil pump. You know, a pump jack. They're all over the West. Nodding donkey is another name for them. They seem to be useful. They're familiar, they're iconic, they're redolent of US industrial history. But are you really telling me that the elegant, silent, clean, modern turbine is somehow uglier than this noisy, smelly, dirty, wasteful bit of kit, which the pump jack is? It's not so great. Oklahoma now produces 28% of its power from wind and has the capacity to provide 10% of all US energy. And this is the heart of Trump country, where people don't believe in climate change. They're not motivated mostly by the desire to reduce emissions. Like other states, its leaders see tapping the wind as an economic strategy. Wind energy is secure, it's clean, inexhaustible. The costs have plummeted in recent years. So even to the unromantic Midwesterner, even to you, Larry, and you might be a romantic, that is strangely beautiful. And I'm looking at a photograph of it now, and there it is, the Nodding Donkey, and this beautiful array of wind turbines.
This is Leah Shade. I teach at Lexington Theological Seminary in Kentucky, and I wrote a book called Creation Crisis Preaching, Ecology, Theology, and the Pulpit. And if I were talking with Larry, I would consider his concern that he doesn't like the looks of windmills along mountaintops or off the shoreline. It bothers him to see the glint of solar panels sprawled across grassy meadows. What I would do is to pull out my phone and Google pictures of mountaintop removal scalping the landscape and coal slag heaps towering over rural towns. I would show him pictures of the abandoned town of Centralia, Pennsylvania, still burning from coal fires beneath the earth's surface. We would look at pictures of oil and gas refineries shooting methane fires into the sky, and oil-soaked birds and animals along shorelines coated from crude from spills and leaks. We would look at clear-cut forests for fracking. And then we would go back to those pictures of windmills and solar panels. And I would ask him, Larry, which landscapes do you prefer? Maybe that would help to give him some perspective.
Thank you, everyone, for your contributions. So you ready for this month's puzzler? Here goes. You're chatting with a neighbor. Let's call her Joan. Joan has family in Florida who were affected by Hurricane Irma. So you start talking about climate change and the connections you see to these current weather events. Joan interrupts you. No, you are wrong. Climate change has nothing to do with these hurricanes. There have always been hurricanes. Scientists make it clear that there is no way you can say climate change has anything to do with a particular storm. So, is Joan right? How can you effectively and accurately talk about these weather events and climate change? I'm interested to hearing what you have to say. Send me your answers, leave your name, contact info, and where you're from. Get back to me by November 15th, 2017. You can email your answers to radio@citizensclimate.org. That's radio@citizensclimate.org. You can also text me or leave a voicemail of 3 minutes or less at the following number, 570-483-8194. Plus one if calling from outside the USA. That number again, 570-483-8194. Well, thank you for listening to this 17th episode of Citizens Climate Radio. The show is written and produced by me, Peterson Toscano. Other technical support from Ricky Bradley. Social media assistance from Ashley Hunt Monterano, Flannery Winchester, and Steve Volk. Moral support from Madeline Pera. All the music we use on the show is licensed unless otherwise specified. Special music for the Art House includes one suite from the 1920s collection on archive.org. Be sure to share Citizens Climate Radio with your friends. Just look for Citizens Climate Lobby wherever you listen to podcasts, which includes iTunes, Podbean, Google Play, TuneIn, and Stitcher Radio. You can also listen at northernspiritradio.org. Join the discussion at our Facebook group page, facebook.com/groups/citizensclimateradio. And you can follow us on Twitter at Citizens C Radio. That's Citizens, the letter C, Radio. Citizens C Radio. Visit citizensclimatelobby.org/blog to see info about our puzzler and find links to our guest. Citizens Climate Radio is a project of Citizens Climate Education.